For more information on ancient dragon Zen Gate and Taigen's teachings, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please click on the link for Just Give on our website.
Good morning, everyone. Stormy morning. My name is Gyoshin Laurel Ross. Taigen is away this week. He'll be back Tuesday, I believe. So he asked me to give the talk today. And recently, actually, he asked me if I would represent Ancient Dragon at a panel discussion that will focus on the subject of forgiveness. And this is at a place called the Temple of Harmony in Joliet. And it's an interfaith panel, and so I was asked to talk about Buddhist and Soto Zen teachings about forgiveness. And the aim of the event is to promote dialogue, they say, and harmony. And I'm going to give this talk today and ask for your input. And thank you very much in advance. Usually, when a person is asked to give a talk, you don't have an assigned topic. So this was interesting. I don't immediately associate Zen or Buddhism with forgiveness. In fact, the word actually brings to mind other religious teachings. Christianity, Jesus. Jesus preached a lot about forgiveness. He preached about turning the other cheek. I think his last words were reported to be, "Forgive them, Father." And I associate forgiveness with people like Nelson Mandela and Martin Luther King and Mahatma Gandhi. I did find a lot of interesting Buddhist teachings about forgiveness. So a standard dictionary definition of forgiveness would be to stop feeling anger towards someone who'd done something wrong and to stop blaming someone. And psychologists might define forgiveness as a decision to let go of these feelings of resentment or vengeance. And these definitions do relate to basic Buddhist teachings about how we would want to conduct ourselves in our lives. So from the oldest teachings, the Theravadan teachings, a sutta called Bala Pandita Sutta, fools and wise people. Monks, these two are fools. Which two? The one who doesn't see his transgression as a transgression, and the one who doesn't rightfully pardon another who has confessed his transgression. These two are fools. These two are wise people. Which two? The one who sees his transgression as a transgression, and the one who rightfully pardons another who has confessed his transgression. These two are wise people. So I see those as sort of the two components of forgiveness: seeing our own mistakes and then pardoning others who have made mistakes. And in our Jukai ceremony, so that's the ceremony that initiates someone into Buddhism, either as a lay practitioner or a priest, we accept a number of precepts to guide our actions in life. And for example, a disciple of Buddha does not kill a disciple, but encourages life. A disciple of Buddha does not lie, etc. Anyway, there is a precept that says, a disciple of Buddha does not harbor ill will, but rather encourages loving kindness and understanding. So ill will, or anger, or hatred, is one of the three poisons that that do great damage to individuals and to our community, our society, and can lead to violence and revenge and all kinds of bad things. So there's also the Buddhist teachings of the paramitas, the perfections, or the virtues, and there are at least three of those paramitas that are directly connected to forgiveness. One would be generosity, another would be patience, and of course, wisdom. So that was my abbreviated literature search into Buddha's teaching about forgiveness. Actually don't find it particularly satisfying to just think about it theoretically. So I would like to think about what we do, you know, what do we do about this? How do we practice this? So I mentioned to Taigen recently that in my zazen and in my dreams in the last year or so, some old memories have been emerging, really old memories, like from when I was a kid. And not, you know, not the happiest memories, but things that are things that I regret, like really negative interaction with my family, sometimes a single sentence that just I feel terrible for being so thoughtless or even cruel. And Taigen said, maybe it's time to forgive yourself for those things. He wasn't at all talking about this this panel, but anyway, so it may not be obvious how to do that. So I have been thinking about it. In the Jukai ceremony that I mentioned earlier, and in a lot of temples, we don't do it here, there's this full moon ceremony, and in the Jukai ceremony, there's an opportunity for repentance. And we chant this chant. It goes like this: all my ancient twisted karma from beginningless greed, hate, and delusion, born through body, speech, and mind, I now fully repent. And we repeat that three times or nine times, depending on the place and the ceremony. And so repent isn't a word that we use a lot in our daily discourse, but in my understanding, it means both to feel sorry for something that you did or that you're responsible for or you see as wrong, and also to promise to or to decide to not do that in the future, to do something better in the future. I actually, in a sangha I used to practice in years ago, in our repentance ceremony, a an incense pot was passed around, and when it came to you, you had the opportunity, you weren't required, but you had the opportunity to say something that you wanted to repent. Everybody didn't do it, but most people did do it. And that was even more, another level more intense than doing it silently to yourself. Anyway, so I think what we're doing in this repentance is not asking for forgiveness, but understanding ourselves in such a way that would lead to forgiveness. So Reb Anderson is actually very, very compelling on this. This is his book called Being Upright, Zen Meditation and the Bodhisattva Precepts. And if you decide to sew a rakusu and be part of a Jukai ceremony here, this is the book that you are asked to study as part of that process. So this is his chapter on confession. He uses the word confession, which is maybe a little bit of a loaded word. He starts out by quoting Shantideva, Indian monk from the 9th century or something. One law serves to summarize the whole of the Mahayana. The protection of all beings is accomplished through examination of one's own mistakes. That's the end of the quote. And then Reb Anderson goes on to say, confession completely purifies our bodies and minds. Practicing it alone or together with others reawakens the heart of compassion and appreciation of others' virtues. Later in the chapter, he says, the greatest darkness for the human mind is to believe that you never do anything wrong or hurtful or stupid. Conversely, continuous confession of non-virtue opens the gate to great light. And then he ends that paragraph with this wonderful sentence, confession of wrongdoing is an act of awakening. Confession of wrongdoing is an act of awakening. And he ends the chapter by saying, fully confessing our human vanity, we're able to forgive ourselves and experience that we are forgiven. So recognizing wrongdoing is waking up basically to what you're actually doing. I mean, you're doing it through carelessness or negligence, even possibly through malice. We are being told this is an internal process of awakening to understand what those actions were and to come to terms with them through this awakening process. I was recently in a meeting with Josho Patricia Phelan, who's a teacher in North Carolina. And she had two other important points about this. And she says, confession doesn't replace the need for an apology, which might be a good idea. I like that. And she also says, feeling regret or remorse is an important part of letting go of anger or resentment, but guilt doesn't serve any purpose. And she says, guilt keeps us stuck in the past. She calls it an exercise in self-absorption. And suggest that once we recognize something that we regret, that we return to the present and meet what is right here. So that's about self-forgiveness. Then we ask the question, so what about forgiving other people? I, for one, just to pick an easy target, find it really hard to forgive Dick Cheney. He is perhaps the most unlikable Buddha I can think of that's alive today. And I find it hard to soften my heart toward, say, environmental destroyers, people who do that for short-term personal gain. And those people haven't repented. I mean, they haven't acknowledged, I don't think, their transgressions. But I think what we're being told in this precept of not harboring ill feeling is that in itself is destructive. There's nothing gained. There's nothing good that comes from this harboring this ill feeling, harboring hate, harboring anger and resentment. I think it's difficult, at least it's difficult for me, to separate the bad thing from the person that did the bad thing. So, I mean, I don't have to feel good about Guantanamo by trying to let go of my resentment toward, you know, the people that made that happen. But it's not easy. My very favorite thing that helps me with that is reciting the Metta Sutta. The mantra, the line that I would take as a mantra. So let one cultivate an infinite goodwill toward the whole world. And the whole Metta Sutta is a very, very powerful message to us to let go of that hatred and resentment in our heart that's so destructive. So several people in this room attended a conference last March. It was the Women's Buddhist Conference, the 10th Annual Women's Buddhist Conference. And the topic was responses to violence. And there were a number of wonderful speakers and panels and so forth. I really recommend it's an annual conference. I don't know what the theme will be next year, but there was a very moving session given by Trisha Teeter, who is she's a priest. She's a Soto Zen priest in the Udambara Temple, which is in Evanston, and one of the ways she works as a priest is that she counsels perpetrators of violence. Basically, she works in maximum security prisons, and she told the story of a man who she was who was a student of hers while he was in prison in Indiana for 10 years, and he was a murderer. He had killed a police officer, and he had received the death sentence. He was eventually executed. And Trisha says about capital punishment, she says, we think it's good to hate what's bad, but what is bad is the hating mind itself. And she said that during those 10 years when she was visiting that prison, that the prison officials would ask her frequently, does he have remorse for what he did? And, you know, she didn't know, but this is what she offered as sort of a insight into that. She said that there was another prisoner on death row with him, and this guy was very, very sick and couldn't really take care of himself very well, and her student took care of him, basically. He made sure that he had food and things like toothpaste, and she saw that as sort of transformation in her student from the person he had been, that was the murderer, to this other person. And then she said that she also talked at some length to the wife of the victim, who was not inclined to be forgiving at all. and who in fact expressed satisfaction at his execution. And it's really hard to imagine her being at peace with something like that. I mean, our criminal justice system is focused on punishment and really feels like harboring ill will and hate to me. I mean, it comes at great cost. It comes at financial cost, but cost to society to have this way of responding to bad things. So sort of a different philosophy is called restorative justice. And it sees crime as not just breaking the law, but doing bad things, but it aims then to say, and what can we do then to set that right? And to me, that seems like much more in the realm of forgiveness and transformation. So the keynote speaker of that conference was a really fantastic woman, a priest called Dr. Panavati, did I get her name right? And she's done a lot of spectacular things. She works with homeless youth in her temple somewhere in, I think, North Carolina. Anyway, she wrote the words greed, hate, delusion on the whiteboard, and she said that our approach to ending violence in the world is really 7 billion individual journeys dealing with greed, hate, and delusion. And she said, you know, I, Panavati, am one of the problems, and it is my job to uproot greed, hate, delusion in myself, and that is what feeds my work in the world. So anyway, that is where I've gotten on this talk, and I on forgiveness, and I'm very interested to hear your responses, your ideas, your insights, and I promise to work more on it. Thank you very much. David.
Part of my practice and how I came to practice is about compassion. It's a big part of my practice. There's a great book by Jack Kornfeld about loving kindness, forgiveness, mm-hmm. and peace. And he starts the book with little sayings throughout, but one of them is, forgiveness means giving up hope of ever having a better past. Mm-hmm. The past is to be, in a sense, to be in the present, we have to let go of the past. And we can't change it. But one of the reasons why I started practice was a book we're doing, Four Noble Truths, were put out, and that there is suffering in life. And the source of suffering is our craving, our desires. And I think what happens, our desire to be right, to feel justice, is what keeps us in this punishment mode and keeps us in this mode of non-forgiveness. Part of my practice every morning, I do the Emijuku Kanan Gyo, which is a prayer of compassion or chant of compassion. And at the end, I ask for the extension of compassion to all beings. And I include in that people who are being tortured. May their hearts remain open while they're, despite their pain, and may their pain cease. But I also ask for the torturers that their hearts may open so they no longer cause pain. And that's part of our four vows that we say at the end, beings are numberless, our vows are to I vow to free them, and part of my taking that on is, if I can't forgive the torturers, if I can't forgive the politicians who think only of themselves and a select few, and if I can't ask for compassion for those who are terrorists and imposing horrible pain upon others, then I am in the same practice as they are. I have to be able to cultivate that compassion so that they can be free as well as myself. And I think that's very, very much a basis of Buddhism and of my understanding of Buddhism. And that is that compassion, being able to forgive so that all beings can be free. And that's what I thought would take to that.
Yeah. Mostly we're not confronted with such... Thank you very much for that. Mostly on a day-to-day basis, we have smaller issues to forgive. I mean, last night I was trying to get on I-90, you know, right where it splits, and I got squeezed between two cars and a big truck hit my car. Nobody was hurt, but my taillight is out, and I thought, forgive this guy now. Like, oh, I just have to. Anyway, it was frustrating. It was really good to have a challenge right in the middle of thinking I was on top of this idea. But I do think not getting immediately angry, I mean, nothing was going to make my car better, so not getting immediately angry at least made the situation a little less ugly in the short run. Anyway. Yozan.
Yeah, just three really brief comments. One about the another really useful line from the Metta Sutta, which I always find useful. Despise no being in any state, which, you know, addresses, I think, both those whom, you know, we need to, you know, forgive in our personal lives or whatever, but also sort of opens a way, as David was suggesting, to, I mean, there's very much in all these things, whether somebody who's imprisoned or somebody who is one of the people who is imprisoning them, or, you know, in certain situations even torturing them, however we look at it, there's always a strong element of you know, to mix, you know, since we're sort of mixing Christian and Buddhist terminology today, you know, there but for the grace of God, you know, go I, and trying to sort of understand those the conditions and respond to it in a wholesome and healthy way. You know, another thing that I think sort of came out a little bit in things that have been said is, I know from my, you know, experience at the Metropolitan Correctional Center, you know, that these are institutions of great suffering, and that when you go into this place, I mean, one of the things that, or a place like this, I'm sure, is one of the things that becomes immediately obvious is that, you know, it's not only the prisoners who are suffering. You know, the whole institution cultivates awful stuff, seems to me, for everybody involved, which is really interesting. And then just a third point, I will try and look this reference up for you and get it to you in case it's interesting. I recently had occasion to hear a public prosecutor speak, and this was a woman whose own sister had been rather brutally murdered, you know, many, like 20 some years ago. And, you know, she was an active Christian and thought, you know, for most of that time that she had actually succeeded in forgiving the young man who committed this crime. But she started to, as her life went on, was sort of experiencing, you know, personal stuff. And part of what her recognition was is that she hadn't completely forgiving this person, and the reason why, even though she'd sort of let it go, is that she had kind of repressed even memory of this person, that she felt that she was obliged as a Christian not only to sort of like let it go, but to make an active effort towards healing And she realized that that involved both herself and this mm-hmm. no longer young man, and establish contact with them. And it was, you know, I won't say more about it, but it was a very moving story about the, as you said, it's not, I think you were quoting Pat Phelan, it's not a passive, it's an active response to the world. Anyway.
Thank you.
Jerry? It's interesting we give this talk now because recently I noticed more, maybe it's just recently, but there are a lot of people who are just like. And I'm working through trying to, what struck me about what you said is the part about, you know, at some point you get, okay, there's no advantage in this. You know, there's nothing to be gained from. Really wanting somebody to not be there. It's interesting because I'm not to the point where I can just let it go and say, yeah, it's okay. But somehow just having the awareness that that sort of path where you want to like get revenge or get back or just...
stewing your juices.
Yes. There's really no advantage. There's no... any kind of gain or value in it, and somehow just that thought is enough to say, okay, you know, just avoid this person or step back until you can get to the point where you can say, okay, I can, you know, live with that. I'm finding it very helpful just to remind myself, okay, you know, you're going to lose in the end if you go down this road. So, mm-hmm. you know, it's not the best solution, but it's a temporary way to keep you in the right direction.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. It's not an easy thing to hold on to petty little squabbles.
Mm-hmm. And Reb says it's part of awakening. Yes, Dave.
So thank you for the talk. Really enriching and wise. When you mentioned guilt, it reminded me of I'm a big music nerd, and there's a song by a band called New Order from the 80s it's called "Guilt is a Useless Emotion," and I always, before it even came here, I always found that title just really striking when I just like saw it on the cover. I was like, whoa, what is that? You know, and like really just meditated on that without, you know, just like, wow, that's intense. But I thought that was powerful, and there's a lot of wisdom to that. So. I have a question, basically, is something that I've struggled with has been the line between the individual and the systemic, or the individual and the idea. Like, how do we, like, I understand, you know, forgiveness or restorative justice in the context of one person to another, but what do you do as an individual when greeted with systems of racism or systems of gentrification? And when there are individuals that are carrying this out, like where is the line where, you know, the prison industrial complex is another example. How do you, you know, because how do you address or identify these practices that society, practices without having it be, you know, an individual attack, or how do we meet those challenges, you know?
Yeah, I have that question too. That's a hard question. I think about, you know, I've been reading some literature recently written, contemporary literature written by Native Americans reflecting on what happened to their culture over the last 500 years. And I think about forgiving the destruction of all those cultures and this continent, and forgiving that kind of thing seems hard-hearted. There's no word for it. I mean, that's why I don't have an answer, but that's why I quoted Panavati saying it's 7 billion journeys. 7 billion, I'm not sure I exactly agree 100% with that, but I like thinking about that part of it, that, you know, if we look at the greed, hate, and delusion in ourselves, that is something we can really work on, and that it has effects well beyond you know, are immediate. But I don't know the answer to your question. Maybe other people have insights.
I don't know if I have an insight, but, you know, you reference people like Martin Luther King mm-hmm. and Nelson Mandela and Gandhi. And people who live lives like that, you know, do... I mean, it makes it clear that, you know, maintaining sort of an attitude of forgiveness or love or compassion, however we want to cast that, does not in itself in any way sort of entail, you know, giving people or systems a pass for right. bad behavior. It's a matter, you know, I mean, as Yoshin said, you know, figuring out how to engage with it in a way that sort of puts out the flames of greed, hate, and delusion rather than feeding them is very, very difficult and probably specific to situations. But, it, you know, there are lives that have shown us that it can be done.
So you just have to be Nelson Mandela.
That's all.
And Martin Luther King.
One more time.
Did you have something to say?
Yeah, this is what's coming up for me in general, but I feel like it's also coming up for me in response to the issue was... So a couple things. So one was that part of it, I think for me, the idea of uprooting greed, hate, and delusion is confusing. Like what anchors me, what helps me actually practice with this, because I think we can enter into this kind of violence with our own selves, and it gets really confusing about so for example when you're in it, I think there's also something that makes us confusing that in our Western culture where there's a lot of self-hating and a lot of self-denying, and I think this is true in oppressed groups particularly, but I think it's culturally like a disease that many of us share, that we do need to be able to set boundaries with others and say, no, that's not okay. I won't be treated that way, or, you know, whatever. But that gets really confusing about, you know, in actual situations or interpersonal relationships, you can carry a lot of pain about that. So if you take this edge of like, oh, no, I'll just forgive this, like, because, you know, you have to walk a line. So for me, the thing that is helpful as a practice around this is just trying to experience what I'm experiencing rather than judging it and saying, oh, this is bad, I shouldn't be feeling this or something. It's more like, okay, I'm definitely feeling something. I don't even know what this is. Is this anger? Is this hate? Is this appropriate anxiety that's helping me set a boundary? Or what is this? I don't even know. But my practice is to sit with my feelings and to go deeper into them. And I think the thing that maybe for the idea of forgiveness is pointing toward is rather than get really attached to a certain idea about something, like, you're an asshole, you know, or Dick Cheney's the worst, you know, you know, and he's just inherently bad, or whatever that feeling is, rather than being attached to an idea about something, you know, or I have a right to know, saying, I don't know. I don't actually know. I don't know anything about Dick Cheney. I know some things about his actions that I have a lot of feelings about. And that I want to keep thinking about. That I'm not just going to turn away from, like, oh, it doesn't matter what Dick Cheney did. It's like, no, these are really important questions about the systems that exist and how and what their impacts are. So I want to keep, but so it's sort of like holding the humility of like, I don't know, which actually allows us to continue the task of trying to understand, that we do want to engage in understanding, but that often when our emotions are really heightened, we're not actually in a place where we can understand things very well, that things get kind of narrowed down to black and white or oversimplified. So going back to Mandela, so I think like, so for me, one of the most inspiring stories around this is what happened, how he navigated, and he and others in his coalition coalition navigated the shift away from apartheid finally when it, after all the decades of struggle and his imprisonment. But when he came into leadership, how he promoted this, you know, the truth and reconciliation process, where it was like the wrongdoing was too widespread to punish everyone, and also he knew that would it would tear the country apart. So, you know, the whole basic idea, of course, which is in restorative justice too, of listening, of trying to understand the other, you know, and so when that's possible, and it's not always possible. So Dick Cheney, you'll never be able to ask him what his life is really like, or what was going on for him when he made these decisions. But there's that spirit of just sort of like, okay, I know that that's my practice, is to try to be curious about the world and about people, and to have a spirit of humility of I don't know, even as I try to keep trying to attend and develop my understanding.
Thank you. You know, sometimes people confuse this precept about not harboring ill will to say you shouldn't ever get angry. And I don't think that's its intention at all. I mean, anger is healthy and normal and appropriate and so forth. But the stewing in one's juices that Jerry was talking about is a different, is a different, but thank you for all that. Other thoughts? Oh, David, I'm sorry.
One other thought. Not during the talk reminded me of something. What we often get caught up in forgiveness is that, you know, we have to accept the other. You know, we have to accept that they're trying their best and whatever they were trying to do to become, you know, happy human beings. We can accept, but acceptance in our language has a connotation of approval.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is to say, I can accept someone, I can understand what happened. I don't necessarily have to approve of them. And that they can still forgive them, but I don't have to approve of their action. And that's where I think some people feel that, you know, forgiveness has to be a should, you know, and I have to be a good person, you know, and I have to accept this person. And that implies I approve of what they did. It's not approval. That you could have your straight, you know, your lines, and your lines of ethics, that I'm not going to be treated this way, this is not a good way to be treated, yet at the same time I can forgive the other person. And that's I think, is a line that sometimes gets blurred, and people have a hard time navigating that murky area, and it's not about approval, but I can accept the Koch brothers, but I hate what they do, you know. I don't approve of what they do. And there's a difference, you know, in that sense. And that's where you have to strive and fight at the same time be able to forgive.
It occurs to me too that one of the things that sort of connects some of the bigger systematic problems with the individual is at some level, and I don't know what this is, but I've thought about this for a while, at some level, we all, whether purposely or not, are working towards building a world we can't live in.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's the, you know, jail system or the oil companies or wars, or whether it's just, you know, do we overeat, do we smoke, do we, you know, do things that aren't healthy for us. And I don't know if that's a human disease or what that is, but there is, you look around and you say, why would anyone actively go towards a world that can't live?
Ancient and twisted karma.
Ancient twisted karma. And somehow when I think about it that way, it sort of helps me get past all these bad people in the world who are screwing it up for the rest of us. What's wrong with them? And not that I agree with them, but it just helps me say, yeah, okay, I get it, don't like me either. You know, we're all trying to work this out, you know, and let's just all take a deep breath here and see what we can do. You know, it goes sort of back to your 7 billion people just trying to figure out what's trying to do.
Thank you. I'm going to make a few announcements before we do our four vows. The first announcement, as Tygan always says, is the most important announcement. There will be tea and cookies afterwards. Between now and then, however, there'll be a short period of temple cleaning. So if you are able to stay and help with temple cleaning, and for our new folks, that's a part of our practice, and it'll only be 15 minutes or so. If you can do that, when we bow out, you should go out that door rather than that door. If you can't stay, that's fine. I did want to mention several really cool things that are coming up. So Monday night, on June 29th, we'll have a scholar named Rook Saporin. He's from U of C. And he will be doing the Dharma talk on Chantai, One Practice Samadhi, as a precursor to Zen meditation. He comes very, very, very highly recommended. And if you can all be there, he has a book coming out, I gather. And then there's another great Monday night.
Okay.
Can you get that while I'm doing these other ones?
Yeah.
That'd be great. On Saturday, June 13th, so this coming Saturday, there will be a Sangha gathering, and everyone would be invited, and it'd be a vegetarian potluck, and it'll be at the home of one of our Sangha members. And the address is on a flyer up front, and it's right at the Brown Line, the Western Avenue Brown Line stop. And that's from 1 to 5, so you could come anytime between those hours. And families and children and friends are very much invited to that. And then, thank you so much. On Monday, June 22nd, we have another guest Buddhist scholar, Dale Wright. And he'll be doing the Dharma talk. His title is The Karma of Community, Social Justice and the Quest for Awakening. And again, he is really highly recommended as a speaker and an author. And then lastly, there is an all-day retreat on the last Sunday of the month, June 26th. There is still time to sign up for that, but the sooner you sign up, the easier it is for planning. So you can sign up by telling one of the priests or Tygan, or just send an email to info@ancientdragon.com. Are there any other announcements? Okay, then we will end by saying the four Bodhisattva vows, which are in your chant card.
Beings are numberless, I vow to freedom. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to rend them.
Dharma
gates are boundless, I vow to enter them. Buddha's ways unsurpassable, I vow to realize it. Beings are numberless, I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless, I